And this doesn't just happen by accident. Wandering out into the middle of that intentional chaos at 2 a.m., surrounded by fire-spewing dinosaurs, giant neon-lit pirate ships, and the throbbing beats of galactic hip-hop, you're ripped away from all familiar reference points, totally unstuck in time, and well beyond normal awareness. The wildness of the event, the radical self-reliance it requires, the ability to create and inhabit larger-than-life alter egos, all combine to create a temporary autonomous zone, a place where people can step outside themselves and become, if only for a brief week, whatever they desire. It's the single greatest concentration of state-altering technology on the planet, designed by everyone together and no one in particular. Which brings us to the final and most important category in our assessment, the astonishing amount of innovation this event consistently inspires. Attendees treat the playa as an oversized sandbox, a place where ideas can be dreamed up, tested out, and, as often as not, shared freely with everyone. "I like going to Burning Man," Google founder Larry Page said at the 2013 Google I.O. conference. "It's an environment where people can try new things. I think as technologists, we should have some safe places where we can try out things and figure out the effect on society, the effect on people, without having to deploy it to the whole world." In 2007, Elon Musk did just that, debuting an early prototype of his Tesla electric roadster at the event. He also came up with the ideas for both his renewable energy company, SolarCity, and his superfast transit system, Hyperloop, while on the playa. And true to the Burning Man principle of gifting, he gave both away. SolarCity went to his cousins. Hyperloop, published online in a white paper, was an offering to the world at large that has since inspired two different companies. Zappos founder and CEO Tony Hsieh told Playboy that the experience of collective awareness, what he calls the hive switch, is the reason he attends. That feeling of unity with the other people in the space, unity with the music and with one another, that's why I go to Burning Man. For Hsieh, the festival has had such an impact that he's built its ideas into the corporate culture of Zappos, reorganizing the company to make flipping the hive switch as easy as possible. Similarly, he's also spearheaded the Downtown Project, an attempt to revitalize central Las Vegas with radical inclusion, interactive art, and other core elements of the festival. While much has been made of the fact that Hsieh's efforts have faced setbacks and challenges, it would be surprising if things went differently. Hsieh has taken ideas pioneered at Burning Man and is attempting to reinvent the culture of a Fortune 500 company and to reinvigorate, to the tune of $350 million, a blighted urban core. That's structural change in the real world, with all the risks and complications it entails. Musk's projects, too, aren't without their complications. But reinventing transportation and pioneering a new energy grid, to say nothing of his efforts to colonize Mars, are wicked enough problems that they've stymied all prior efforts to solve them. What these examples make clear is that the perspective provided by non-ordinary consciousness and culture offers a different path forward, a way to reconsider intractable challenges with fresh eyes. All of these practical applications have, in turn, inspired the Burning Man organization itself. A few years ago, we attended the event to speak at their annual TEDx series, and then got invited to a small salon hosted by Danger Ranger. And it wasn't just Silicon Valley tech titans in attendance. Senior vice presidents from Goldman Sachs, heads of the largest creative ad agencies in the world, and leaders of the World Economic Forum were all discreetly there, using fanciful assumed names, far from the flashbulbs and scrutiny of the media and the markets. Their goal was to forge a future based on the shared experience of communitas writ large, a permanent Burning Man community, a place where experiments with the four forces could be conducted year-round. As Burning Man co-founder Will Roger recently wrote, "I would argue that the proposal is part of a large strain of utopian separatism that can be found in the modern tech boom. Peter Thiel's seasteading efforts, or Tony Hsieh's attempt to build a startup city in Las Vegas. But a Burning Man permanent community would arguably be the most interesting and achievable manifestation of it." In the summer of 2016, they achieved just that, closing on the purchase of Fly Ranch, a parcel of nearly 4,000 acres a few miles north of the festival site, filled with geysers, hot springs, and wetlands. "This is all part of the evolution of Burning Man," the organization announced, "from an ephemeral experiment into a global cultural movement having an impact on social, economic, and artistic norms and structures. Burning Man's culture is becoming more recognized and influential around the world." When the Levee Breaks. One of the more interesting parts of this story isn't simply that burners are trying to establish a homeland for ecstasis. It's that some of the hardest and grittiest lessons of building a city from scratch are showing up thousands of miles beyond the Nevada desert. So, if we want to continue our exploration of how non-ordinary states are helping to solve wicked problems in the wild, then we should head to some of the wildest places on Earth, those ravaged by natural disasters and protracted war. To better understand how a week-long gathering could have such far-reaching impact, it's important to understand that in preparation for the event, all the central Burning Man organization does is survey the streets and put out porta-potties. Everything else about the makeshift city, the camps, the giant art, the generators, the medical facilities, and the peacekeeping, is organized by volunteers. In coming together to create a city of 70,000, burners are pioneering fundamentally different ways of organizing and mobilizing people in the face of some of the harshest conditions on the planet, and they're using the bonding power of communitas to do it. One of the first times those skills truly got put to the test was in 2005. It was August 29th, and over on the Gulf Coast, Hurricane Katrina was less than an hour from making landfall. By the time the storm was over, it would spread $108 billion of damage from Florida to Texas and earn the dark honor of being one of the five worst hurricanes in U.S. history. Over in Nevada, meanwhile, it was sunny skies and light winds, and Burning Man was in full swing. Camp Playagon, a combination of Playa and Pentagon, was bustling. A collection of high-ranking Pentagon officials, futurists, and hackers, Playagon had been charged with setting up and running the live-stream broadcast and emergency Wi-Fi for the entire festival. But when news of Katrina reached them, they took a break from their duties to get a closer look. "One of our guys took over a recon satellite," recounts Dr. Bruce Damer, a University of California biomedical engineer and NASA contractor. "Our Pentagon wireless satellite phone rang. The general on the other side was saying, 'What's going on?' and instructing our guy not to answer. We then had control of this thing and could watch Katrina come in. And never once to miss an opportunity for a high-tech prank, the Playagon crew lit dozens of hydrazine flares, military-spec glow sticks, around their camp, and programmed the satellite to track the blaze from space, too. But those real-time feeds of Katrina lashing the Gulf Coast had a sobering impact. The citizens of Playagon wanted to help. So did plenty of other burners. After gathering more than $40,000 in relief money from concerned attendees, an advance team left the festival, drove down to the Gulf Coast, and got to work. With Doctors Without Borders as their inspiration, they dubbed their nascent organization Burners Without Borders. At the time, New Orleans was getting all the national attention, but these burners decided to focus their efforts on coastal towns in Mississippi, which had been equally damaged but largely ignored. The first thing they did was set up shop in a parking lot and build a much-needed distribution center for established charities like Oxfam and the Red Cross. Then, over the course of 8 months, they donated more than $1 million in debris removal and reconstruction efforts. The organization did everything from restore a Vietnamese temple in Biloxi to raise and rebuild the entire town of Pearlington. As CNET noted, this was no ragtag group of 10 to 20 hopeless do-gooders showing up without a plan. This was more than 150 people toting heavy equipment, supplies of food and water, and years of experience surviving and thriving in harsh, off-the-grid environments. Before leaving, they teamed up with local residents to build a giant sculpture out of flood debris and, true to form, turned it to ash in a giant cathartic bonfire. "Our town was destroyed and we were abandoned by our government and our leadership," one Pearlington resident said. "But Burners Without Borders came in and reminded us that even in all that devastation was the chance for art, for celebration, and for community." Since that time, Burners Without Borders has become an international organization, active in disaster zones from Peru's 2007 earthquake to Japan's Fukushima disaster to New Jersey's Hurricane Sandy. And the relationships they forged with locals in those areas have come full circle, with leaders from those communities coming to Burning Man in subsequent years to learn where all of that capability and enthusiasm comes from. In an even less likely example of Burning Man's spreading impact, Dr. Dave Warner exported its core ethos to war-torn Afghanistan. In 2011, Warner, a data visualization expert and the guy who had hacked that Katrina satellite, was in Jalalabad, just 30 miles from the caves of Tora Bora, where Osama bin Laden had given U.S. forces the slip a decade earlier. A large man with long graying hair and beard, Warner has a resume that reads, "Former U.S. Army drill instructor, PhD neuroscientist, technotopian idealist, dedicated burner, dabbler in psychedelics, insatiable meddler, and, weirdest of all, defense contractor." Warner and a gang of MIT scientists, who called themselves the Synergy Strike Force, had posted up in Jalalabad to spread the gospel of open information. Based on the Burning Man principle of radical inclusion, Warner insisted that all Synergy Strike Force projects remain unclassified and that the information be shared with everyone. "I'm dismantling the Death Star," he told a war reporter, "to build solar ovens for Ewoks." So Warner opened a burner bar where he traded free drinks for terabytes of information. It was more of a tiki hut, really, covered in bamboo, a simple cooler with some Heineken and the odd bottle of liquor displayed, but also a sign that read, "We share information, communication, and beer." In their intelligence gathering, no detail was too small. Reconstruction projects, troop movements, construction plans, hydrology surveys, health clinic locations, polling sites, names of local farmers, even crops those farmers were planting. Warner took all the information from his Beer for Data program, as it came to be known, and plugged it into a data visualization tool he had created. The results outperformed every three-letter agency you can think of, and, because Warner had refused a security clearance, he could gift anyone who asked with these results. Lots of people asked. The Pentagon relied on his data, but so did the United Nations, Afghan officials, aid workers, and journalists. In one of the most chaotic environments in the world, gifting, transparency, and radical inclusion saved lives and dollars. While Burners Without Borders and Beer for Data mark two of the earliest examples of festival principles being exported into crisis zones, they're unlikely to be the last. With so much experience in self-organizing their own municipal infrastructure in a hostile environment, former Apple executive Peter Hirschberg wrote in his book, From Bitcoin to Burning Man and Beyond, "Burners are particularly skilled at functioning during chaotic crises when normal services, running water, electricity, communication channels, and sanitation systems are not available. Burners don't just survive in such an environment, they create culture, art, and community there. It's for this reason that Rosie von Lilla, a former head of community affairs for the Burning Man organization, has been invited to the Pentagon 3 times and the United Nations 2x to discuss infrastructure and disaster planning. "I've been amazed at the depth of interest," von Lilla says. "Traditional organizations are realizing the limitations of top-down mobilization and are seriously studying how bottoms-up community mobilization, the core lessons of the Burning Man community, can be deployed in critical environments." Or really, in any kind of environment. Burning Man demonstration projects can be seen everywhere, from solar power installations on rural Indian reservations, Black Rock Solar, to experimental community spaces in blighted metropolitan areas, The Generator in Reno, Nevada, to smartphone apps, including FireChat, which was designed as a peer-to-peer communication network at Burning Man, but then played a critical role in protest movements in Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Russia. And because burners vigorously defend an open-source, non-commercial approach, their efforts are easy to share and hard to censor. Burning Man regional burns now occur in nearly 30 countries, from Israel to South Africa to Japan, providing global access to the experience. It's been called a countercultural diaspora, but that might be too limiting. After all, what's countercultural about disaster relief, intelligence gathering, and urban planning? These projects all provided creative solutions to persistently wicked problems, ones that defied the best-laid plans of the most powerful militaries, governments, and aid agencies on the planet. Relying on the ingenuity, collaboration, and relentless hard work of a community forged by ecstasis, burners are extending their impact well beyond the celebration that birthed them. Burning Man didn't invent the festival, the art car, or the temporary autonomous zone, any more than Apple invented the personal computer, continues Hirschberg. But like that other venturesome innovator, Burning Man executed the concept beautifully, and through its work is having an outsized impact on our culture, and quite possibly, on our future. Disrupting the Brahmins. While Burning Man principles and skills are being deployed in some of the harshest conditions on Earth by volunteers with limited budgets, a large number of the examples in this chapter have involved the creative class, that is, people with the resources, influence, and time needed for such pursuits. And typically, that's the way these things have always worked. At least as far back as the Eleusinian Mysteries, which counted notables such as Plato and Pythagoras among its members, ecstatic culture has often been spread by an educated elite. In Europe, we saw this with the Rabelaisians of the 16th century and the Club de Hashish in the 18th century, both of whom explored altered states, open sexuality, and libertine philosophies in pursuit of inspiration. In the 1920s, socialite Mabel Dodge Lujan's Taos home served as a mescaline-fueled salon for everyone from D.H. Lawrence to Georgia O'Keeffe and Carl Jung. In the 1960s, Esalen's founders and faculty infused Bohemia with academia, drawing heavily from the ranks of Stanford, Harvard, and the European intellectual community. Yet, even though these movements all began with a select few, they ended up having a disproportionate impact on philosophy, art, and culture. In July 2013, we experienced a contemporary instance of this dynamic in the mountains of Utah, where a small but influential group of innovators are building community based on what they call the power of shared peak experiences. Guided by Jean-Baptiste and his New Orleans marching band, we found ourselves in a large crowd of artists, activists, and entrepreneurs, traipsing through an aspen forest. After about 30 minutes, the procession arrived at a wildflower-strewn meadow and the largest dinner table either of us had ever seen. It was a quarter mile long, a single straight line stretching across the whole of the hillside, with white linen place settings for 1,000. As we sat down, we noticed all the little details expressly designed to prompt awe and delight, like hand-crank radios playing jazz from a pirate AM station, and stainless steel whiskey flasks with Walt Whitman poetry inscribed on their side. The hosts proceeded to serve everyone by hand, laying out an inventive multi-course meal. Then, timed perfectly with the rising full moon to the east and the blazing sun setting in the west, everyone raised a glass to the palpable sense of community present that night. After dinner, the entire forest transformed into an LED wonderland. Sound stages were playing everything from pulsing electronica to spoken word poetry. Butterfly and glowworm art cars buzzed soundlessly up and down the dirt paths. And in the distance, scattered across the hillside, were the domes, tents, and pavilions that housed everyone gathered to connect and collaborate over this midsummer weekend. As much as the fingerprints of Burning Man were everywhere at this event, the remote setting, the glamour camping, the art, performance, and whimsy, there were two crucial differences. Not only did it take place at 9,000 feet above sea level, but it wasn't going to disappear at the end of a week. This summertime gathering was a coming-out party. Just 7 weeks earlier, the hosts, Summit Series, had bought the entire mountain. "We wanted a permanent home," explains Summit co-founder Jeff Rosenthal. "We wanted to build a town dedicated to what altered states really can provide: creativity, collaboration, innovation, entrepreneurship, and community. And because our community shared that vision, we were able to crowdsource $40 million and buy a ski area, Powder Mountain, that sits on a mountain range the size of Manhattan." So while folks at Burning Man are just starting to build themselves a homeland, Summit has already taken that step. Already there are more than 500 home sites on the land, with people like Richard Branson, Kobe Bryant, GE's CMO Beth Comstock, and Nike president Trevor Edwards already committed to the project. And instead of the typical McMansion resort plan, they are actively fostering community by prohibiting oversized statement homes and concentrating development into tightly clustered neighborhoods. Everything is being built to platinum-level LEED environmental standards. It's the world's first ecstatically inspired eco-town, though it didn't start out that way. Summit began in 2008, when five entrepreneurs in their early 20s came together to solve a common problem. They didn't know any really successful entrepreneurs and had no one to ask for advice. So the quintet came up with a creative solution: cold call business leaders and ask them to go skiing. 19 people showed up, including Zappos's Tony Hsieh and Facebook co-founder Dustin Moskovitz. "We learned that when you take a bunch of really bright, diverse people," explains Rosenthal, "and let them share a dynamic, immersive experience, you get powerful results. Lifelong friendships were formed. It removed the tedious, transactional nature of networking. I guess you could say that one of the things we discovered on that trip was that altered states accelerate business." This one-off experiment soon became the Summit Series, a string of non-conferences built upon those original insights. The series, which has been called TED Crossed with Burning Man, or the Hipper Davos, has struck a chord. Summit's first event was a ski trip for 19 people. Their second event was a trip to Mexico for 60. And their third event was at the White House. After hearing about the organization, President Obama invited them to bring 35 young leaders to dinner for a discussion about millennial culture and the future of innovation. And what they shared at the White House, and have been implementing ever since, is a vision of social entrepreneurship that values both purpose and profits. Today, when Summit hosts a weekend, you'll find little-known entrepreneurs, activists, and artists mingling with the likes of Questlove, Eric Schmidt, and Martha Stewart. This kind of cross-pollination has produced some interesting collaborations. Summit mobilized a team of marine biologists, adventurers, and philanthropists to organize a Protect Our Oceans trip through the Caribbean, and raised more than $2 million to establish a nature preserve. They've supported Pencils of Promise, a nonprofit dedicated to global K-12 education that's built almost 400 schools, and helped launch Falling Whistles, a global network of over 120,000 members dedicated to eradicating child soldiers in the Congo. But it's not just nonprofit work they're interested in. They've also begun a venture capital fund that has helped seed dozens of startups, including the Buy One, Give One shoe company, Tom's, the eyeglass upstart, Warby Parker, and the ride-sharing giant, Uber. By using non-ordinary states to promote community, they're reimagining the staid world of professional networking, philanthropy, and venture capital. And Summit isn't the only organization leveraging those lessons to accelerate change. Mai Tai Global, started in 2006 by venture capitalist Bill Tai and kitesurfing legend Susie Mai, uses action sports, mostly surfing and kitesurfing, as a stimulant for group flow and entrepreneurship. Theirs is a potent partnership. Bill Tai sits on the boards of a half dozen of Silicon Valley's best-known companies, while Susie Mai is the only woman to be awarded lifetime status as a Red Bull athlete, one of the ultimate honors in action sports. Mai Tai hosts multi-day gatherings that blend kiteboarding sessions, off-the-record conversations with founders, startup pitch marathons, and a transformational festival atmosphere. "We curate our experiences very strategically," explains Susie Mai. "We find the right mix of really interesting people and subject them to powerful, state-changing experiences that accelerate social bonding. It's the same formula used at Burning Man and at Summit." Mai also points out that there's a lot of crossover between these cultures. "Very early on, we got a lot of support from the Burning Man community. Burners instinctively understood what we were trying to do, so they just started showing up. And it's a very participatory community. So when burners do show up, they build stuff, they start organizing, they get everyone involved. Very involved. To date, dozens of companies have leveraged the talent and contacts in the community to raise venture funding and find key partners, most done with handshake deals on the beach at the end of a great kiting session, when, as Tai says, everyone's feeling the stoke. They've also come to see action sports as a filter for startup success. We've noticed that learning to kitesurf has a lot of parallels with the challenges of entrepreneurship," Mai explains. "If someone has the grit and presence of mind required by the sport, then it shows a lot about their character and how they show up more broadly in life. And the parallels aren't just conceptual. Over the years, Mai Tai members have founded and led companies with an aggregate market value of more than $20 billion, making them one of the more influential and athletic groups of entrepreneurs in the world." Building on these insights, Mai Tai recently created the Extreme Technology Challenge, abbreviated to XTC, naturally. Rather than having promising startups pound the pavement in the hunt for funding, the challenge gathers them together at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas for a pitch fest meant to invert this process. Instead of droves of founders showing up for a series of 30-minute meetings with venture capitalists, explains Tai, and those founders then having to backdoor vet prospective leaders, we spend real time together in an environment where a person's true character is revealed. Finalists receive an invite to Richard Branson's Caribbean hideaway, Necker Island, where, between kitesurfing sessions, they get to pitch Branson himself. On Necker, as at Burning Man and Summit's Powder Mountain, everything is deliberately designed to create communitas. We experienced this firsthand when we were invited to the island to talk about flow and entrepreneurship. From the cliffside zip lines that carry you to breakfast, to the stunning Balinese-inspired architecture, to a broad menu of action sports, everything is built to trigger that state of effortless focus. "When I do reach flow," Branson told us over smoothies on his back porch one morning, "I get an extra 2 hours of great work done, and the other 12 are really, really productive. So trying to get that balance in life is really important, not saying that one shouldn't party hard as well." Branson and Mai Tai are taking this same approach to host the Carbon War Room, a transnational organization dedicated to energy sustainability in the Caribbean, and the Blockchain Summit, an international consortium exploring socially beneficial applications for alternative currencies. By bringing the passionate and talented together to play and work, they're charting a course toward a more innovative and sustainable future. Case in point, a cedar hot tub perched on the crow's nest of the main house of Necker Island. Guests gather there to soak, talk, and gaze at the stars. And it was at one of those late-night gatherings that Branson birthed his most ambitious company yet. "That's where I had the idea for Virgin Galactic," he reflects. "NASA hadn't yet created a spaceship I could fly on, and if I waited too long, I wouldn't be around. So I thought, let's build our own. I mean, who in their right mind wouldn't look up at those stars and not dream of going there?" And getting innovators into their right minds is what Summit, Mai Tai, and Branson have done so well. By realizing that non-ordinary states are more than just a recreational diversion and can, in fact, heighten trust, amplify cooperation, and accelerate breakthroughs, a new generation of entrepreneurs, philanthropists, and activists is fundamentally disrupting business as usual. High Times on Main Street. If the only evidence of the four forces showing up in the world was to be found at exotic gatherings for a fortunate few, their impact would remain severely constrained. Trickle-down ecstasy. But what is emerging is more varied than that. The ripple effects of these innovators' companies and projects are even beginning to show up on Main Street itself, and they're following a predictable pattern of dissemination. In his seminal book, Crossing the Chasm, Jeffrey Moore outlined exactly how new ideas gain traction. At first, when breakthroughs happen, only those people willing to tolerate the risk and uncertainty of a novel technology get on board, a trade they'll make for the benefits of being early adopters. Then there's a gap, what Moore called the chasm, that any idea has to cross to attract a growing audience. It's attracting that early majority on the far side of the chasm that he feels is the true mark of disruptive innovation. Up until now, we focused primarily on the pioneers and early adopters, those most visibly driving the evolution of the four forces. Here we want to take a moment to catalog signs of broader applications, focusing on the places where the chasm has been crossed and a critical early majority are starting to incorporate state-changing tools and techniques into their everyday lives. Take the first force, psychology. Thanks to the work of Martin Seligman and others, a new generation of positive psychologists is repackaging meditation, stripping out its spiritual connotations, and providing evidence-based validation for its benefits. This new version, known as mindfulness-based stress reduction, is gaining traction in places that would never have embraced earlier variants. 18 million Americans now have a regular practice, and by the end of 2017, 44% of all U.S. companies will offer mindfulness training to employees. Since rolling out their program, Aetna estimates that it saved $2,000 per employee in healthcare costs and gained $3,000 per employee in productivity. This quantifiable return on investment helps explain why the meditation and mindfulness industry grew to nearly $1 billion in 2015. What had been the domain of seekers and swamis is now a staple of HR. And the impact of positive psychology is spreading well beyond the workplace. At Harvard, Professor Tal Ben-Shahar's course on happiness is the most popular in the university's history, while mainstream books on the science of well-being consistently top the bestseller lists. And this focus on optimal living isn't just bettering our mood, it's advancing our growth. One of Bob Keegan's graduate students recently determined that by college, many millennials have reached stages of adult development with all their associated increases in capacity that took their parents until middle age to attain. We're seeing similar progress in neurobiology. Legitimized by discoveries in embodied cognition, contemplative physical practices like yoga, tai chi, and qigong have become the most popular indoor activities in the United States. Consider yoga. This 5,000-year-old tradition was a countercultural pastime until the 1990s. But once researchers began finding the practice did everything from improve cognitive function to decrease blood pressure, the general public started to cross the chasm. As of 2015, some 36 million Americans have a regular practice. An activity that changes our state of mind by changing the shape of our bodies has become more popular in terms of participation than football. On the higher tech end of the spectrum, state-changing treatments like transcranial magnetic stimulation are now outperforming antidepressants, and many Silicon Valley executives are going off-label, using the technology to defrag their mental hard drives and boost performance. Companies like Dave Asprey's Bulletproof Executive are helping people biohack their daily lives with everything from smart sensors to nootropics, brain-stimulating supplements. This market is expanding so rapidly that Bulletproof has grown into a nine-figure enterprise in less than 4 years, and hundreds of other companies are flooding into the market. In pharmacology, we're increasingly accepting of substances that shift our consciousness. Marijuana, once called a demon weed, has become the fastest-growing industry in America. The whole of the cannabis economy, including legal and medical, is now worth roughly $6.2 billion and slated to rise to $22 billion by 2020. As of late 2016, 28 states have legalized medical marijuana, and 8 of them, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, Nevada, California, Massachusetts, and Alaska, and the District of Columbia, have legalized recreational use as well. Over the next 5 years, researchers believe another 14 states will follow suit. As Peter Reuter, a University of Maryland drug policy professor, recently told CNN, "I'm surprised by the long-term increase in support for marijuana legalization. It's unprecedented. It doesn't look like a blip." And cannabis is merely the most obvious sign of this change. Whether we're examining psychedelics like LSD or empathogens like MDMA, mind-altering drugs are more popular than at any other time in history. 32 million Americans use psychedelics on a regular basis. That's nearly 1 in 10, and report considered reasons for doing so. According to a 2013 study published in a journal of the National Institutes of Health, the most common motivations are to enhance mystical experiences, introspection, and curiosity. Transcendence, not decadence, appears to be driving use forward. Technology has seen similar developments. A few decades ago, brain imaging devices were multi-million dollar machines available in only a handful of university labs. Today they've become as ubiquitous and accessible as the smartphones in our pockets. With a handful of plug-and-play sensors, we can now measure hormones, heart rates, brain waves, and respiration, and get much clearer pictures of our real-time health. In the summer of 2016, for example, Jay Blahnik, the lead designer of the Apple Watch, gave us an early look at their product roadmap. Over the next few years, the watch will connect these sensors to become a platform for open-source research into everything from obesity to peak performance. In one 24-hour beta test, more than 30,000 people volunteered to contribute their personal data to Alzheimer's research, making it four times the size of the next largest study overnight. And Apple is only part of a larger trend. Between 2000 and 2009, companies filed fewer than 400 patents for neurotech. That number doubled in 2010 and doubled again in 2016. With the data these devices are providing, we can shortcut our way not only to better health, but to deeper self-awareness, taking weeks and months to train what used to take yogis and monks decades to master. While these are all examples of the four forces reaching deeper into the mainstream majority, they may already seem unremarkable. There's a reason for this. Ray Kurzweil, the director of engineering at Google, once pointed out that it's hard for non-scientists to track progress in artificial intelligence because when it shows up in the real world, it looks like nothing fancier than a talking ATM. It's true for ecstasis as well. Soccer moms with kundalini yoga practices, businessmen microdosing psychedelics, tech nerds tracking biometrics, The Simpsons going to Burning Man. These developments might seem pedestrian, but they are the talking ATMs of altered states. They are proof that the chasm has been crossed and that the once cutting edge is now integrated into the everyday. Nothing new under the sun. Under the hot August sun in the western wilds of America, tens of thousands of misfits gather to worship and celebrate. These seekers are there because they reject the stuffiness of their parents' religion, but are equally uninspired by the godlessness of their transient society. They crave direct mystical experience, and they have come together to find it. They stay up all night dancing, playing music, getting intoxicated, and crowding together to see the headlining performers. Standing on giant scaffolds, these artists whip the crowds into a collective trance. When the mood takes them, and it often does, attendees have sex under the open sky. Afterward, when they go back to their regular lives, they transform the world as they know it. On fire with their recent initiation, they challenge existing social, political, and spiritual conventions. So noticeable are their efforts that the towns and cities where they congregate are called burned-over districts. There was a time and a place when this all happened, but it wasn't the present day, and it wasn't the Black Rock Desert. The date was 1801. The place was Cane Ridge, Kentucky. The occasion was the Second Great Awakening, one of the largest spiritual revivals in American history. The ink was barely dry on the Constitution, and the western boundary of the United States reached only as far as the Appalachians. But already the foundation of a vibrant American ecstatic tradition was being laid. Those gathered in Cane Ridge were part of the largest revival of that era. More than 20,000 settlers camped out, listening to itinerant preachers who stood on elevated platforms to speak to the frenzied crowds of the coming rapture. In between sermons, people hung out by their tents and lean-tos with fiddles and banjos, playing the Scots-Irish tunes that would later become bluegrass music. And despite the ostensibly pious intent of the gathering, there was plenty of drinking and fornicating. Even back then, the Holy Ghost feeling was tough to keep under wraps. These revivals offered connection and community in a world that felt fragmented and hectic. Over the next half century, an entire generation of the young and passionate joined in. The Second Great Awakening gave birth to social justice movements ranging from temperance and women's rights to abolition. It infused American politics with an activist conscience for years to come. Even Joseph Smith's Hilltop Epiphany took place in one of those burned-over districts. So as we consider the emergence of the four forces and where they lead, it can be helpful to realize that the revolution we're experiencing today might be more the norm than the exception. American spirituality has always favored the direct over the inferred, the immediate over the gradual. It has always spilled over from the pews and pulpits into the towns and countrysides. In this context, we could consider this current moment as a great awakening in its own right. Only this time, the mythical has been replaced by the empirical. From the Nevada desert and the disaster zones of the Gulf Coast and Afghanistan, to the mountains of Utah and the sidewalks of Main Street, people are coming together to see for themselves. And what they're discovering is that there's more capacity, resilience, innovation, and creativity in all of us collectively than in any of us alone. That's as significant today as it was over 200 years ago. So even if there really is nothing new under the sun, each time it rises, it's still a sight to see. Chapter 9. Burning Down the House. Even though a critical mass of the population may be crossing the chasm and incorporating the benefits of non-ordinary states into their lives and work, that doesn't mean this revolution won't cause problems. Historically, every time ecstasy has shown up, it's led to upheaval and misuse. That's because, while the insights provided by the four forces may give us a better way to stabilize these experiences and lessen that risk, there will always be those who try to bend them to other ends. Back in the section on pipers, cults, and commies, we touched on these dangers, examining the pitfalls that non-ordinary states can pose for individuals and groups, namely the dual issues of coercion and persuasion. Here we're going to expand that thread by focusing on two of the institutions with the most vested interest in coercion and persuasion today, the military and marketers. We'll start with militarization, reviewing more than half a century of government attempts to weaponize consciousness. Then we'll move into commercialization, where the power of ecstasy is being used to open our wallets. This latter category is a more recent development, to be sure, but one with a high potential for abuse. In both cases, we'll see how the application of non-ordinary states, as with other powerful technologies, has both ethical and political ramifications. The Atomic Donkey. It was 1953, and the Pentagon had a problem. Colonel Frank Schwabel, a U.S. Marine Corps pilot, had been shot down over North Korea, appeared on Chinese radio, and confessed that he'd been ordered to deploy biological weapons. The event was a PR nightmare. If the Pentagon let Schwabel's story stand, they'd be caught in violation of the Geneva Convention. If they discredited his account, they'd be undermining a decorated officer and prisoner of war. So the Secretary of Defense demanded, as Annie Jacobson recounts in her recent book, The Pentagon's Brain, an all-out campaign to smear the Koreans with a new form of war crime and a new form of refinement in atrocity techniques, namely mind murder or menticide. If Schwabel had been the victim of communist mind murder, then his testimony could be invalidated and his patriotism upheld, a tidy solution to a messy problem. Menticide, most in the Pentagon agreed, was a clunky word. But the CIA had been discreetly testing a more compelling tagline in New York Times op-eds, brainwashing. This one stuck. Brainwashing neatly encapsulated one of the deepest fears of the Cold War era, the idea that your very individuality, your own free will, could be hijacked by a totalitarian state. The CIA sowed the specter of brainwashing so successfully in the minds of the American public and within its own operational culture that it came to be considered one of the primary threats of the Cold War. So even though they'd dreamed up this boogeyman themselves, perfecting mind control devices and drugs to combat it became a top-secret, top priority. Not long after Schwabel's radio announcement, the Department of Defense got wind that a brilliant young University of Pennsylvania neuroscientist might have discovered the very technology they'd been seeking. Representatives from nearly every government agency, the CIA, NSA, FBI, Army, Navy, Air Force, and the State Department, all beat a path to Dr. John Lilly's door. Lilly had solved the two biggest technical problems of mechanically inducing ecstasy on demand. The first was that inserting electrodes through the skull and into the brain invariably caused too much damage. The second was that pulsing unidirectional current across nerve endings tended to irreparably cook the circuitry. But Lilly had developed tiny stainless steel sleeves you could tap into a subject's skull and then slip gossamer electrodes through, with virtually no swelling or lasting harm. He'd also built a machine that sent bidirectional electrical pulses through the brain that stimulated neurons without knocking them out of balance. The procedure itself was virtually painless, nothing more than pinpricks as the sleeve guides went in. The electrodes could be inserted to any depth in the brain, from the cortex down to the amygdala, and the guides could remain embedded and undetected for months or even years. In primates, Lilly had discovered that the pleasure system, what could be called the brain's basic ecstatic circuitry, correlated directly with the sexual arousal network. Male monkeys trained to use his device for self-stimulation would choose to orgasm nonstop for 16 hours, followed by 8 hours of deep sleep, after which they would get right back to it. Pleasure, Lilly had discovered, was an endlessly motivating and potentially all-consuming pursuit, at least in males. For this reason, when the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH, told him to brief the Pentagon on his work, Lilly expressed concern. "Anybody with the proper apparatus can carry this out on a human being covertly," he recounted in his autobiography, The Scientist. "If this technique got into the hands of a secret agency, they could have total control over a human being and be able to change his beliefs extremely quickly, leaving little evidence of what they had done." To guard against this, Lilly detailed a series of non-negotiable conditions under which he would be willing to discuss his findings. Nothing he said could ever be classified, and everything shared would remain experimentally repeatable by him or his colleagues. Long before Linus Torvalds gave away the source code to Linux, or Sasha Shulgin published his chemical cookbook, or Elon Musk shared all of Tesla's car and battery patents, long before there was even a term for it, Lilly took a stand for open-sourcing ecstasy. What he hadn't counted on was how relentless the military could be. Not long after that initial presentation, Lilly was contacted again, this time by an unnamed representative of the Sandia Corporation, a Lockheed Martin subsidiary and longtime defense contractor. He wanted to learn the technique of inserting the sleeve guides into the heads of large animals. Again, Lilly insisted on keeping the work declassified, but agreed to let the man come and film his latest experiments. A few years later, Harper's Magazine wrote an in-depth piece on Sandia, detailing their Super Mule project, a donkey-horse hybrid equipped with electrode implants and a solar compass. The mule carried its load, quite likely a suitcase nuke, in an exact straight line, regardless of terrain. If it veered, it was punished with pain. If it tracked, it was rewarded with pleasure. As he read the piece, Lilly was shocked to recognize a photo of the man who had filmed his experiment. Sandia had managed to take mechanically induced ecstasy and harness it to wage nuclear war. Devastated, Lilly realized that before he could complete his research, government agencies were going to co-opt it. He disavowed experimenting on animal or human test subjects, concluding that self-experimentation was the only ethical way to explore the boundaries of the mind. He left the NIMH and ceased all research with neurophysiological aids. Yet despite his abandoning his position and his funding and risking his reputation and ultimately his life, Lilly's work would prove endlessly fascinating to the military and intelligence communities for decades to come. He who controls the switch. In 2010, Tim Wu, a professor at Columbia Law School, discovered that information technologies, ranging from the telegraph to radio, movies, and ultimately the Internet, tend to behave in similar ways, starting out utopian and democratic, and ending up centralized and hegemonic. In his book, The Master Switch, Wu calls this the cycle, a recurring battle between access and control that shows up whenever these breakthroughs emerge. History shows a typical progression of information technologies, he explains, from somebody's hobby to somebody's industry, from jury-rigged contraption to slick production marvel, from a freely accessible channel to one strictly controlled by a single corporation or cartel, from an open to closed system. When radio operators began stringing up towers in the early 1920s, for example, it was so people could talk to each other and share ideas over an open broadcast medium. All these disconnected communities and houses will be united through radio, as they were never united by the telegraph and telephone, wrote Scientific American. But that's not what ended up happening. By the mid-1920s, AT&T and RCA teamed up to create the National Broadcasting Corporation, NBC, controlling access to bandwidth and creating a massive multinational company that persists to this day. By the 2000s, another juggernaut, Clear Channel Communications, controlled market share and playlists in more than 30 countries. This was unification, for certain, but not of the democratizing variety imagined by the early pioneers. Because of the inevitability of the cycle, Wu believes there's no question more important than who owns the platform, the means by which people access and share information. It's what prompted him to coin the term net neutrality back in 2003 and spawn an ongoing conversation about the balance of civic and corporate power online. It's also where he got the title of his 2010 book. Before any question of free speech, he writes, comes the question of who controls the master switch. While information technologies started out concrete and physical, ranchers putting up telegraph wire to connect their farms to town, and radio stations building giant AM antennas, they're getting increasingly virtual. The ones and zeros of the Internet and the infinite complexities of Google's search algorithms. And with the four forces, information technology is moving from the virtual to the perceptual. Ecstatic technology isn't limited to silicon chips and display screens. As John Lilly's early research established, it's the knowledge of how to tweak the knobs and levers in our brain. When we get it right, it produces those invaluable sensations of selflessness, timelessness, effortlessness, and richness. And that final step, the richness? That's the information that we can't normally access. As W.B. Yeats put it, the world is full of magic things, patiently waiting for our senses to grow sharper. Once information technology becomes perceptual, as in the case of non-ordinary states, the cycle becomes even more powerful. Our mind becomes the platform. The tug of war between access and control becomes a battle for cognitive liberty. And while nation-states have consistently sought to regulate external chemicals that shape consciousness, what happens when they attempt to regulate internal neurochemistry? If that sounds far-fetched, consider that elite athletes already submit biological passports to the World Anti-Doping Agency to confirm their unique baselines for hormones, blood profiles, and neurochemicals. If they fluctuate from that baseline without official permission, they are penalized and even brought up on criminal charges. Much in the same way that regimes used to declare certain books subversive, it's not too much of a stretch to imagine a government declaring certain brain chemistry subversive. A telltale combination of neurotransmitters coursing through your bloodstream could be enough to get put on a watch list, or worse. So while it's tempting to herald the four forces as a development that is going to unlock ecstasy for the masses, we'd be naive to think that a persistent historical pattern, the battle for control of the master switch, won't apply this time around. Spooks to Kooks. The struggle over Lily's brain stimulation